This Do Lectures episode features writer and consultant on human behaviour, Mark Earls, recorded live at the Global Event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2010.
Very nice to be here. I'm absolutely excited, ecstatic about being here. I speak at a lot of conferences and this is the one I want to come to. So I'm honoured to be part of this. And I've been looking forward to it all year. The thing that I'm going to talk to you about today is human behaviour and a little thing in our understanding of human beings that can help all of us get our ideas spread a bit further. Because the truth is, and I'm sure everyone in this room has got ideas or behaviours they want to change and spread through the population or technology they want to get out there or whatever. And the truth is, we're really not very good at it. This is a guy who's sort of a human landmark from my childhood, and some of you at least will be old enough to remember this guy. This is Stanley Green. He passed away nearly a decade ago now. And he spent 26 years marching up and down Oxford Street with this board, right? With a very sensible message on it. It'll be badly copywritten. I'm sure somebody here can give him a hand. And the message was this: for a healthier lifestyle, less promiscuous sex, a bit more exercise, and watch what you eat. I mean, no health minister anywhere in the world is going to disagree with it now. But Stanley was singularly unsuccessful in spreading that message through the British population. What he managed to do is get arrested a number of times. He was particularly aggressive towards young ladies who are scantily clad. There we are. That's his thing. He made his own uniform, by the way, that sort of Maoist look. He made that himself. And he printed thousands of these beautiful... If you go to the London Museum, they've got the original printing press and this beautiful hand-set pamphlets he wrote and sold for various prices. Eventually, it went up to 7p in price after 23 years. Anyway, so that's Stanley. And for me, he's emblematic of all of our attempts to change human behaviour and spread our ideas through populations. Because the truth is, we're really not very good. Most governments, anywhere in the world you care to look, most government campaigns to change the behaviours of their citizens result in bugger all change, whether it's to do with healthy lifestyle or whether tax compliance or speed or anything else you care to think of, crime. Mostly the change comes and goes naturally without government having any real impact on them. This is why it's very easy for whichever government, whichever party is in opposition, whichever country in the world to say, you see, it's wasting money. Sounds like a song we're hearing a lot at the moment. Wasting money trying to change people's behaviour. But it's also true in management. If you work in a large corporation, you've probably been through at least, let me see, two change management programmes in the last couple of years. I've been involved in my career, my long and not so illustrious career, in so many change management programmes, either on the inside or the outside of them. And I've got a selection of T-shirts and photographs from that off-site we did. Wasn't that fun? And we redesigned it. And always, a couple of years later, you go, so who's that guy who sits in the corner of the organogram with a budget? No, I can't remember what that... No, that was two change management programs ago. We had that new approach. It was going to be all important. And no one's got round to telling him. So change management literature, ladies and gentlemen, can sum up in this very short phrase. Change management changes nothing, mostly. Which is why there are so many change management consultants out there, after all, right? Because if it was good at changing people's behaviour in large organisations, then they would have changed the shit and we wouldn't have to bother again. But it rarely changes, so we have some more change management consultants in. That's also why all the money that's wasted of our pension funds in mergers and acquisitions activity in Wall Street and the City of London and the equivalents around the world. It's all wasted because it's more than twice as hard to get two organisations full of people who distrust and dislike each other to do the one thing you want to do than it is to just get one organisation. It's more than twice as hard because you get all the mutual hostility and group identities. The facts are, and this is a PwC fact, is that 2/3 of all M&A activity actually reduces shareholder value. 2/3 of M&A activity is to shareholder value. If you want to grow, don't buy, mostly, unless you've really got close cultural fit and you're really clear about it. Okay, so that's the bad news. Oh yeah, there's marketing as well, yes. Most marketing fails to change people's behaviour. There's some great exceptions. Apple, God bless them. Blessed Steve, that's marvellous. But most marketing doesn't trouble the score after a couple of periods, sales periods. really difficult to tell any effect. So there are some great successes, but most marketing doesn't really do that. And I've been responsible for quite a few of those ineffective marketing campaigns over the years. So our attempts to change people's behaviour, and not just at the small level, but at a sort of higher level, population level or a company level, are really not very good. And then at the same time, we get surprised and, confused when stuff does turn out to be popular. Like, how did that happen? This is the second, last year, the second, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt Hart somewhere, this is the US's second biggest selling artist, recording artist last year, Subo. When I questioned someone at the label about this, they said, well, it's clearly she's got a fantastic voice. And you go, yeah, there's lots of people with fantastic voices, and there were actually quite a few people in the competition who had fantastic voices. Yeah, but it's that and the tragic tale. And you go, yeah, but, that's not unusual either. And she looks like the back of a bus. And you go, well, that's really not very nice, is it? But that's not unusual either. The fact is that we don't see all the ones that failed who had exactly the same characteristics. She got lucky. She got lucky. And we get surprised by this, and then we try and explain it through her, some special qualities of her. But we get surprised by that stuff. We get surprised by other stuff. A few years ago, just down the road, small town of Bridgend had a spate of teenage suicides. And it just happens regularly in different parts of the world at different times, and people try to explain it in different ways. It's a terrible thing whenever it occurs in a community, explained by that terrible thing, the internet. Of course, it's the internet is to blame. Then it was drugs, then it was unemployment, so we blame big stuff out there doing this stuff to our kids. Then it was something in the culture has gone wrong. You only have to go back and just go to your undergraduate sociology library, and it says a book by Emil Durkheim, published in 1907. It's called On Suicide. And it shows very clearly that suicide isn't something that's to do with the thing, with people's independent action, but it's to do with some other stuff, with what's going on around them. But we get surprised and confused, and we can't really explain the stuff that happens in our world very well using the assumptions that we've got. Why is this important to us? Well, I use the metaphor of touchdown Jesus. Has anyone seen this marvellous, marvellous thing? If you're a terrible heathen like me and will burn in hell forever, then you'll find this very amusing. On the 15th of June, the church, this church here on the left, which has a statue of Jesus apparently having scored the winning touchdown in the Super Bowl, right, got struck by lightning. And that's him on the right. Lots of people would find this very funny, right, in our little world, social media world, which I did. And so it hit the news, local news, and hit national news in the US, and very quickly went around the web through news channels. And there was lots of good gossip about, is this God's punishment for them not being anti-gay enough, and, Seriously. I just want to show you this little chart, and I won't go into the details. We can talk about it afterwards in chat if you want. This is just the Twitter stream for the next 24, 30, 36 hours following the event happening. And this is the bit of spreading activity that we normally worry about. It's characterised, statistically, we can discuss this later, but just trust me on this. This is when the news story broke. This is beamed at the lot of you, if you like. And this is people talking to each other and spreading the word. You do exactly the same shape for something like when Michael Jackson died. Bang, like that. And then I was on holiday in Mallorca, and I got texts from three or four people, Michael Jackson's dead. Do I care? But anyway, it's a subject of conversation. And that subject of conversation, the area under here is three times what it is under there. We think we try and spread our ideas about what we're going to do to people. We don't think what they're going to do to spread it for us. And that's whether you're in marketing, or whether you're in charity campaigning, or whether you're an activist, whether you're a manufacturer, whatever your interest, you need to think more about the social bit where people are doing the heavy lifting of diffusion than what we do to them. And I think that's really exciting. Now, the next slide, I'd just say thank you very much to John, who's reconstructed this. John in the green room reconstructed. Good play, my little illustration. This is a piece of science which we're now going to reenact. This is the do lecture, so we're going to do something. So if you've got a cup of tea on your lap, I suggest you put it on the floor and get ready to do this. It's really simple, and we can all do this. This is, like I say, a scientific experiment. It's data that's collected regularly by a Hungarian research team who go around the world and look at soccer stadiums and film the crowd and not the pitch. No, what's going on the pitch. Anyway, we'll start this side. Okay, on a count of three, one, two, three. Oh, that's a bit wimpy. Oh, come on. We'll try it again. One, two, three, and this time, can I suggest you A, stand up, and B, make a noise. One, two, three. Brilliant. And again, one, two, this end. One, two, three. Oh, lovely. Lovely, marvellous. Now, before we start, I saw this look of fear in a number of people's eyes. Oh, fucked. Audience participation. When you do it, it's actually quite fun. It's okay, isn't it? What this reveals, this is for me, I find this really interesting. This is such an easy thing to do and people enjoy it. No other species on this planet could do this. Do it together. Such complicated exercise, be so well synchronized with each other. And for me, it's a good way of summing up the little thing that I told you about human behavior and human nature that I think can change all of our attempts to spread our ideas. And that's that we're fundamentally social. Not just a bit social, not we kind of like hanging out with other people who are a bit like us, but fundamentally social. We as a species, a primate species, like all primates, are social creatures who distribute security, provision, and more than other primates, we distribute and share the looking after provision for our kids, for example. And we're supremely adapted for that. And most of our life, as Thomas Schelling, Nobel Prize winning economist, says, most of our lives consist of individuals responding to a context, of other individuals' responses to a context, of other individuals' responses to the people who were there in the first place. You cannot escape other people, real or imagined. However hard you try, this is what we were born to. We're supremely adapted to it. Getting that allows you to think very differently about how you spread things. Let's deal, though, with the existing model. Most of us have been taught, and it's our culture in particular, it's very different in other cultures. Many Asian cultures and African and Latin cultures are very different to our Anglo-Saxon assumptions. But our culture tells us that we're individuals who act independently of each other, who think before we act. Remember your mother telling you, did you not think? And you try and make up some excuse about, well, I was thinking that, and somehow that was going to be okay. Of course you didn't think. Nobody thinks. Daniel Kahneman, another Nobel Prize winning economist, who's the father of behavioural economics, he says, thinking is to humans as cats, as swimming is to cats. Thinking in humans, swimming cats. We can do it if we really have to, but mostly we don't. Well, in fact, we'll do almost anything to avoid it. He developed this lazy brain hypothesis, which is again and again established now, that we basically don't think. We do stuff based on shortcuts. Thinking comes a bit later, indeed. One way of explaining this, one of my mentors is a guy called Andrew Ehrenberg, who died recently. He's a marketing academic. And he summed up 35 years of crunching behavior and attitude data in marketing world and with this simple thing. He says, opinions come after behavior and not before. What you were talking about before, Andy, what do we want them to think? We're going to tell them. We don't tell them anything, is one really important implication there. Opinions follow behaviour and not the other way around. His personal summary of this is, and excuse me, Sarah, when I say this, when you watch the film, it's not me talking, it's him talking. I have to think my girlfriend is attractive because she is, after all, my girlfriend. That's the kind of way it works. Jeff Goldblum in the movie The Big Chill says much of the same thing. In fact, some of you, I'm sure, will remember that. There's a moment in it where he's got to speak as a cynical journo to a camera. And he says, don't knock post-rationalisation. It's more important than sex. When did you last go for a whole week without a really juicy post-rationalisation of your own behaviour? That's where the thinking seems to go in our individual heads. But, as you'd imagine, for this supremely adapted social creature, a lot of thinking is in fact best understood as a social thing. Not as I think, something between my ears, but we think. Individuals using the brains of other people. Now, a lot of our brains, it's a supremely adapted social primate, are about other people. You know, that seems Nicholas Humphrey, who was one of the guys, as a psychologist, invented the what's called the social brain hypothesis. That's what our brains are for. Observed, he was doing work with Diane Fossey, with gorillas, and then shortly afterwards with Richard Leakey on digging bits of early humans out of the ground in Africa. And he made this observation that, that despite the fact that gorillas have really very big brains compared to the size of their bodies, they don't use them for thinking that they can do in the labs when we test them. What they use them for is keeping an eye on what other people are up to, understanding and remembering the relationships that people have, keeping score. If you like, empathising with other people. So it is with us. Most of our brain is the neocortex, the new bit that gives us a sense of our own identity and so on, is in fact devoted to the world of other people and living through other people. We think with other people an awful lot. Things like distributed memory. If you've been to a party or if you came to do lectures last year, you might bump into people and go, do you remember the time when? And together you tell a story better than you can on your own. Similarly, the wisdom of crowds phenomenon is something that, you know, is generally accepted now as being possible in certain circumstances. They're probably overclaimed. That together we're smarter than we are separately. But that's just the beginning of it. One of the things about our wonderful species is that we manage to outsource so much knowledge, and it's one of the reasons why we're so successful, outsource so much knowledge from the individual brain to the brains of people around us. So when you go into a room, you can tell what's going on. You can tell where the cool stuff is, you can tell where the danger is, you can tell where the authority is, just by watching other people. There's a famous experiment which explored this basic premise from Stanley Milgram, great social psychologist in the 60s, and he took his graduate students out into the streets of Queens, and he got one to stand on the street corner and watch what passers-by did. And one person pointing at the sky gets no response from New Yorkers, unsurprisingly. Two, ditto, it's just New York, right? Weirdos. Three, starting to get some bits. When you get to five people standing at point of the sky, the passers-by go, what? What's going on up there? We use people all the time as their perceptions of the world to shape our perceptions. And we do it also in, not just in those kind of ways, but we do it in a specific way using something which is so countercultural to our culture that I ask you to take a deep breath when we explore this a little bit. And this is the tiny thing that I think you can put to work to spread your ideas better. Behold, 70s psychologist Andy Meltzoff from Princeton. He did these great baby gurning experiments, basically getting small children at various ages and making faces at them and see whether they copied or not. And 42 minutes old is the youngest. Where were social services at the time, we ask ourselves? Could he do it now? Anyway, he discovered this. Human beings copy earlier, they copy more accurately, they go on copying for longer than infants are close cousins. And this is cross-cultural. It's not like it's an American thing or an Anglo-Saxon culture thing or a developed versus undeveloped thing. It's completely cross-cultural. It's a human trait. We copy early. And of course, sometime about puberty, this stops. Bollocks, it doesn't. Sometime about puberty, it just continues and gets more and more as we come in contact with more people. If you have kids around you, you know they pick up stuff all the time from other people around them. Pick up stuff from you, normally the bad words. This is so important in our worlds that some scientists now started to describe our species not as Homo sapiens, but as Homo mimicus, the one that copies everyone else. And do you remember this scene from this movie 21 years ago? The director's mother here, Estelle Reiner, is sitting at the table, and Meg Ryan's just done that banging the head on the table, making those strange noises kind of shtick, and I'm never sure what that's about. But anyway, Estelle says these simple words, I'll have what she's having. I'll have what she's having. And that, if you remember, I'll have what she's having, you're more likely to spread your idea and your behaviour around the world. This is what fashions are spread by. All of these guys think they're really individual, but they're not. They're individual in a very similar way to everyone like them. This is from Arif Asluse, a fantastic photographic archive. The brands we buy, the names we give our kids, the dog breeds we have, the songs we choose to listen to, all of this is shaped by what other people around us are doing. Let's have a little look before we finish at this. Many of you will have seen this film, right? So it's a guy called Colin from Calgary at a dance festival. Dance music festival in Canada, and he wants to get the crowd going. Colin is, like many other people of at festivals, he's got his shirt off and having a bit too, probably overstimulated, I suspect. He's got a mate that he's encouraged to join him, but that doesn't really seem to do anything. Even in a moment, you'll see there's a fat friend who's joining the stage. I'm going to start with my rolling line. Get the party going, but hey Johnny. But it's only when lots of other people join after that that the thing actually turns in. What I want you to do is watch the audience below, not Colin, because frankly at these festivals there's always someone with a shirt off overstimulated dancing away. Fat fella, come on. One, two, three. There we are. So he's gonna do his stuff and that still doesn't get anyone going. Now, this was sent to me by a couple of creative guys from New York who said, yeah, here's the crazy ones, the bold ones who go out there with their shirts off first and invent the dancing thing. And I just thought, that's nonsense. It's completely the other way around. It's the crowd waiting for, there we go, three or four people coming at once. And all of a sudden, the crowd down below are suddenly interested. There's a girl in the foreground who's wearing a yellow, there we are, yellow, her head just appeared there, a yellow dress. And you'll see her pretend to be putting suntan cream on. And then pretend to be stretching, and then eventually she'll run off and join. People doing what other people are doing, they're having what other people are having. Not make any rational decisions, not thinking about it before they're out, they're just doing stuff. And this shapes so much of our lives, and it goes on. There, she's got the suntan lotion on, and now ready to... She's gonna run off now, oh, she's friends, right. I think that's it, I'm gonna go. There we are. Of course, this is completely countercultural to all of us, because you and me, we all think of ourselves as great creative individuals who shape our own lives, right? And Oscar is our representative in this sense, and Oscar Wilde despised people who copied each other. But ladies and gentlemen, it is the key to how things spread through populations. Samsø, outside Copenhagen, is a little island that became energy self-sufficient through social mechanism, through people being encouraged to do stuff together and see other people doing stuff together and see other people adopting and talking about it and being excited. This is a simulation of obesity spreading through a population in a small town in Massachusetts over 32 years. The yellow dots are obese people. You see there are more of them, they become more central, and they become bigger themselves in the 32 years. And by the way, if you notice, if you're into that kind of thing, the network actually changes as this works. So, got to the end of it. There's one that, there we are. In order, before we think about what you might do to make this, I'll have what she's having work for you, we're gonna do something, again, just to finish, if that's all right. Have we got time to do that? Good. So everyone stand up, please. And again, suggest you put down pens, paper and stuff and drinks. What I'd like you to do is to turn to the person next to you. Has everyone got someone they can turn to? This sounds like a group counselling session. Has everyone got someone to play with? Yeah? If you're at the end of the row, can I suggest you move out slightly? Just clear your space. If you're at the front, we need to turn to that person and look them in the eye. Face on, right? Now I want you to stick your hands out, elbows by your side, hands out like that, and then hold the other person's wrists. Right, there is going to be a prize for this competition. And do you want to judge it, Andy?
Sure.
Okay, you judge this. And it's the two people who get their partner off the ground the most times. You've got to get your partner off the ground the most times in the next 30 seconds. Go! Very good. Thank you.
Okay.
Do you want to have a winner?
Yeah, no, we've got, it's very, very close. Very, very close. On the left-hand side, we've got David and John Heslop. Very, very good. But the winner's actually in here with the glasses and the grey T-shirt. On to the most jumps. You two here. Fantastic.
Very good. Very good. So...
You two, sit down, everyone, please. You two, please, please come see me afterwards and give me your details and I'll mail you a copy of the book.
Okay.
Thank you. Now, listen, just to pick up there. First thing is, there was a little bit just at the front here and some at the back there of some wrestling going on. I did this in Norway last year. I think it was Norway and someone went to hospital because I got thrown across the room. Because wrestling's really big. Now, wrestling is what it feels like when you want, when you're trying to make someone do something, persuade them, incentivize them one way, to make them do the thing you want them to do. Let's not do that anymore, please. That's how we've approached behavior change till now, fundamentally. Making people do the things we want to do. It's far more fun to do something together. Do something together. Fun stuff together is even better. And there was a really interesting moment where, and this lasted about 3 minutes before more than half of the room were bouncing up and down together like that, which is a really good and easy solution to spot, and it's the most common one that comes out again and again. But it spread around the room, from some people wrestling, people going, what do we do? What do we do? What's the problem? What are we supposed to try and do? It's a bit of that, and then it's, whoa, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And that was people saying, I'll have what she's having. If you can't see what other people are doing, you can't have what they're, you can't ask for what they're doing. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the most important thing to spread your ideas. Think about the space between people. Think about allowing them to have what other people are having. Thank you very much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.